And get tuned to WBAI, broadcast at 99.5 FM and on the World Wide Web at WBAI.org. It is 10 a.m., 85 degrees in New York City, going up to a high of at least 90 degrees today. Coming up next, the joy of resistance. Please stay tuned.
Now the question is, what is a resistance? What is an organized resistance to these people who are hurting us? Number one, no one who hurts us has a right to do it. And anyone who says they do is wrong. And if it's a court, the court is wrong. And if it's a president, the president is wrong. And if it's the United Nations is wrong. A resistance has to be active. It can't be passive. It can be pacifistic. It can be nonviolent, but it can't be passive. It can't be just in your heart where no one can find it. It has to be somewhere where someone can see it and know about it. It has to be real. It has to be concrete. It has to be day in and day out. It has to communicate itself to the other side so that people who hurt us do not do it with impunity, so that everyone knows that we do not grant the right to anyone to take our rights away from us. It has to be committed, and it has to be for the duration, and that means for a long, long, long time.
No, regret rien. I regret nothing. Sung by Edith Piaf. This is a song that Andrea Dworkin, author, activist, freedom fighter for women, picked to be played at her memorial, and so it was. And before this, you heard the voice of Andrea Dworkin. Andrea left us too early at the age of 58, and today we will be hearing sounds from her memorial that took place on May 25th at New School University. It will include voices of Catherine McKinnon, Gloria Steinem, Robin Morgan, Judith Malina, and many others. Also, you'll hear more of Andrea and a special guest in our studio, all on Joy of Resistance, Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI. So please stay tuned.
Father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
And good morning. This is the Joy of Resistance, WBAI's Multicultural Feminist Radio Program. This morning, we're going to be looking at the life of Andrea Dworkin, a radical feminist freedom fighter for women who left us in April of this year. And we're going to be playing sounds of the memorial to her on May 25th. I'm going to give you a little bit of Andrea's bio for people who don't know who she was. And this is from material put out by her life partner, John Stoltenberg. Andrea Dworkin is an internationally renowned feminist activist and author who has helped to break the silence around violence against women. In her determination to articulate the experiences of poor, lower-class, marginal, and prostituted women, Dworkin has deepened public awareness of rape, battery, pornography, and prostitution. She is co-author of the pioneering Minneapolis and Indianapolis ordinances that define pornography as a civil rights violation against women. She is the author of 13 books of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. She is a political artist of unparalleled achievement, and I'm going to just give you a little idea of some of her writing. And by the way, you can find a complete list on the WBAI website, will be up during today, and that's at www.wbai.org. Let's see. She wrote her first book, Woman Hating, in 1974. She wrote Our Blood, The New Woman's Broken Heart in 1980, Pornography, Men Possessing Women, 1981, Ice and Fire, 1987, Intercourse, 1987, Pornography and Civil Rights, A New Day for Women's Equality, Letters from a War Zone, 1989, and just goes on. Her last book was Heartbreak, The Political Memoir of a Feminist Militant in 2002. And she was indeed an extremely inspired person who wove together in a very unique web the ideas of pornography, prostitution, rape, and the violence and intimidation that women experience every day. I have here in the studio with me a guest, the Reverend Rosemary Bray McNatt, who is a former senior editor at Essence Magazine and a Universalist Unitarian minister. Did I get that right, Rosemary?
Well, for us you did. It's Unitarian Universalist, but because we're a historically Universalist church, it's great.
Okay, I was close.
You were close.
And Rosemary was the MC of the memorial that you're about to hear, and she knew Andrea. She was a friend of Andrea's.
Mm-hmm.
And Rosemary, I want to give the audience some idea of the of who Andrea was, in your words, in a few minutes, but I want to first ask you a question that's been really intriguing me. You say in the memorial, which our audience will hear, that Andrea Dworkin was the Malcolm X of the women's movement. Can you explain that comment?
Oh, sure. In all of Andrea's work, there is a sense of provocation, of pushing the boundaries about women, about men, about our relationships, and about patriarchy that engendered such incredible controversy in people. But she asked the questions that no one else would ask. And in that sense, she exists very much in my mind in the way that Malcolm X existed in the Black Empowerment Movement. There was a great ferment around Malcolm X because he spoke the unspeakable about Black people and their empowerment and their self-identity and their agency, their ability to think and act and speak for themselves, whether white people liked what happened or not as a result. And Andrea always brought that same sense of integrity and radical self-identity and agency to her work. She wanted women to think of themselves as moral agents. She wanted women to be very clear about their humanity, and she wanted them to make sure that they acted like the human beings that they were.
Well, she certainly was a polarizing figure.
Absolutely.
And she is loved and she is hated. She is stereotyped probably more than any other feminist I know of.
I think that's absolutely right.
And maybe you could talk a little bit about personally who she was and contrast that with some of the stereotypes.
Well, to know Andrea, it was to know a really bright, really funny, really warm, and in some ways very fragile person. She was fragile, not in a more delicate way than I think people could ever imagine from reading her. But she was a playful person. She was always teasing me as I was beginning to make this decision about going into the ministry, because I was an editor before, that I was too much of a humanist to be a minister. And I kept explaining to her that Unitarian Universalists are humanists in a lot of ways, and so it was okay. But it was very hard to look and listen to the stereotypes about her and think of her. When we were having dinner, she and John, her partner, and my husband and I, with our new baby, and the way she played with the baby and how hilarious she was and what a great time we had that particular night, and all the times we had where Andrea and I would be engaging, even when we did not agree on a particular thing, but with the humor that she brought to everything. It was almost impossible to reconcile that version of her with the things that people made up about her, right, which were just astonishing.
Which were absolutely astonishing.
They really were.
Yeah. Andrea pulled no punches, you know, from the way she looked, right? She wore her overalls.
She did not care what people thought about her. And there was a fierceness about that was really inspiring. You always thought, boy, I'm not there. I can't do that. But you got to love it when you watch it, because she really meant for people to take her on her terms. And you either took her or you left her.
Right.
And those of us who took her found a wonderful and warm friend.
Right. And she was as uncompromising about what she had to say about male supremacy and the climate of violence and sexual degradation.
Absolutely.
That characterizes our society.
Absolutely.
Of women, I should say.
And that's another reason that Malcolm X comes to mind when you think about her, because he was just as uncompromising about black people's integrity and self-identity. And she was not interested in making sure you liked her. There's a quote we'll read later about how she was not the fun kind of feminist. And if she was doing her work, she wasn't. When you were hanging out with her, she was a lot of fun.
Right. Right. All right. We're going to go now to the memorial that took place on May 25th at New School University. We'll be hearing you, Rosemary, I think, leading off. And actually after some of Andrea's music, because her favorite music was at this memorial, which
That's
she
right.
had picked out,
mm-hmm.
I think we're going to hear some Bach unaccompanied cello music to lead in a little bit. And we're also going to be reading, since at the memorial there were quotes of hers from her work flashed on the screen to the background of John Lennon's Imagine, also which she picked out. And we can't do that because we're on the radio. You and I are going to be reading some of those quotes in
right.
a little while. All right, let's go to that cut.
I think that what we're dealing with prostitution in all of its forms, is the most basic kind of power there is. It's a core definition of power. And that is, I want it, you do it. I want it now, you do it now. Bend over. And when someone has that kind of power, that's the same kind of power that kings had in feudal societies. I think that we make a terrible mistake whenever we talk about prostitution or prostitutes outside of talking about male dominance, because neither exists outside of male dominance. And in the egalitarian world that we want to create, neither would exist. Prostitution is trafficking in women for profit. All right? What it isn't is fun, a form of sexual liberation, a good time, a counterculture indulgence, just another form of work. It's organized profiteering for money in human beings. It is a slave trafficking.
And that was actually the voice of Andrea Dworkin. And now we're going to go to the memorial.
When we look at prostitution, we are looking at an institution in which a group of people are held captive. And those people are gotten there in various ways. And those ways are clear and easy to understand. Many of the women are victims of incest. Many of the women are prostituted by their fathers or by other members of their family, sold into prostitution or sold into pornography, used as children. Poverty is a political issue even when it happens to women. Women are in prostitution because we are poor, because we get hungry, because we get cold. Women are in prostitution because of force, because somebody takes us and makes us be there. Sometimes through causing us physical pain, through rape. Women are in prostitution because women have second-class status. And when you start out being an incest victim and being poor and having been raped by a pimp, then your second-class status means that there's a lid on you to begin with, and somebody's feet have ground you down to the ground. The most essential precondition for ending up in prostitution is that you are the daughter of a woman. You are the daughter of a woman who is the daughter of a woman who is the daughter of a woman. That is the first condition.
Good evening. We are so grateful to you for being with us this evening to honor a friend and a warrior, a woman I once referred to as the Malcolm X of the women's movement. We have memories of Andrea to share tonight. Among them are statements from those people from different parts of the world who could not join us this evening, but are with us in spirit and wanted to share these words of tribute to her. From Christopher Kendall in Australia. Andrea Dworkin gave those of us who could not speak a voice. She brought our realities to the attention of those who simply refuse to see the inequalities that make silence and invisibility so pervasive for all persons harmed by misogyny, homophobia, and racism. Because of her, many of us now can and will speak, and we will ensure that her voice is heard loud and clear. When the pornographers and pimps and bigots abuse, we will fight back, and we can, because Andrea has given us the strength to do so. Her fight for justice, for a better world in which the hierarchies that harm are tackled head-on, will continue as all of us find strength from her courage and a life that, despite countless obstacles, made our own lives safer and more secure. There will be other tributes later in our program. At this time, I'd like to welcome to the stage Gloria Steinem and Catherine McKinnon.
I've arrived at that time of life, as some of us here have, and if we're lucky, all of us will. When going to memorials for many people we love will not be so rare. But I have to say that nothing prepared me for today or for this moment. Not for a memorial like this for a woman more than a dozen years younger than I. Not for Andrea, who, though we are all irreplaceable, seemed somehow to be even more so. Not for a unique writer who was in the midst of a book about the American literary tradition with a depth and breadth that no one else can complete for her. Not for someone who never got the joy and satisfaction she wanted most, that is, from seeing violence against women not only defined, but also diminished. Not for someone who was so clear, and so misunderstood. Not for someone who was so fierce and yet so vulnerable. I was counting on her living longer than I, so I could learn from her words, have her and John's company at dinner and the movies many times more, argue fiercely with that great gift of mutual love and respect that allows us to argue passionately without having knots in our stomach. I wanted her to have more health and more joy, more time to write through the night, as she so frequently did, more moments of knowing she was both loved and understood by many. Because, make no mistake about it, she was clear. And in the end, that is the one and only consolation, that she has left us with her words, never calculated, never honed to please, always with the intention of telling the whole truth. Because we've come to see Andrea as an extraordinary figure, I think that sometimes we forget that she was an ordinary woman. She was a woman like those she wished to defend. So I'd like to share these lines with you. Woman hating was not an attempt to prove, she said, a particular thesis about women or about male domination. Rather, it was an attempt, quote, to find out what had happened to me in my marriage and in the 1,001 instances of daily life where it seemed I was being treated like a subhuman, unquote. At the time she wrote Woman Hating, Dworkin did not know other battered women existed. She said, I still thought I was the only woman in the world to whom it had ever happened. Nonetheless, she experienced the torture and beatings as entirely impersonal, as having to do with her not as an individual, but solely because she was female. When this individual who hit me, it was because I was a woman. There is simply no other way to describe it. I mean, the reason may have been that the laundry wasn't done right or that the refrigerator wasn't cleaned, and I may have been confused by trying to understand how my whole life and all my aspirations had somehow come down to trying to figure out how to clean the refrigerator the right way. But the fact of the matter was I was hit because I was a woman. Likewise, those from whom she sought help, friends, family, neighbors, a doctor, ignored her personal pleas and protestations. People sent me back because I was a woman. People didn't believe me because I was a woman, so that my own individuality or my own personality or my own intelligence or my own insensitivity had absolutely no meaning in the real world in which I was living. If we remember Andrea's words, if we remember that she was a real and an ordinary woman, and that all women are extraordinary women, then we will be carrying on her spirit and her truth. Kitty?
In an elegant arc from The New Woman's Broken Heart to Heartbreak, first book to last, Andrea Dworkin believed writing could move the earth and raise the dead, at least the living dead. Her writing did. Since her death, beneath the keenings of grief and outpourings of love and calls to militancy, you can hear her heartbeat in women moving still. From her writings, you feel you know her, and you do. One woman, she was as tender as she was fierce. Her great subject was women's embodiment in social space, seeking a home of our own that was the whole world. She knew what she was talking about. Her howls of pain, the burning of her outrage, lit up the sky. Really, she burned up her life to make her work. As her character, Andrea, put it in Mercy, her novel, as she immolated herself, "Mama, I made some light." By that light, women could see ourselves hurt, and so we could see ourselves home. The clarity and depth of her identification as a woman, with all women, drew women to her. Grounded in this connection, her method raised consciousness raising to a literary art, mining her own experience without projecting her personal limitations onto her politics. Andrea was a subtle analyst of ideology and identity, a pioneer of the sexual in life and letters and law, in and as politics. Taking up the most denigrated and ignored of people and topics, reading silences, scrutinizing the meaning of dirt for chapters, shunning sentimentality, she transformed old ideas, cruelty, communion, honor, and in our work together, equality. And she forged new concepts, woman-hating, possession, scapegoating, marking them indelibly. A freedom fighter for the voiceless, she did not substitute her voice for theirs or appropriate theirs to amplify hers, but gave us our own. It feels like the North Pole is gone now. To get our bearings, we can start by valuing each other in the way that some people now seem to wish they had valued her. We can speak with integrity, remembering, as she once said, telling the truth takes practice. She paid for it, but she did it anyway. "Why is it," she asked me years later, "that the better my work gets, the harder my life is?" We can think carefully about things people avoid thinking about and why. As she once said, our pornography ordinance does, we can solve problems some people don't want solved. If you're ever wondering what would Andrea do, think principle first, practicality second, and then act. If her books are her remains, as John has said, we are her legacy. Really, it's the history that we make from here that will determine how she is remembered. As a living political memorial, pass the anti-pornography ordinance, giving prostituted giving prostituted women some human rights and doing something to stop rape. She can't anymore, but you can. Anywhere.
We are back in the studio. I'm Fran Luck. I'm here with Rosemary Bray McNatt, and we're going to be reading quotes from Andrea Dworkin's work. Rosemary.
The body must be freed, liberated, quite literally, from paint and girdles and all varieties of crap. Women must stop mutilating their bodies and start living in them. Perhaps the notion of beauty, which will then organically emerge, will be truly democratic and demonstrate a respect for human life in its infinite and most honorable variety.
The discovery is, of course, that man and woman are fictions, caricatures, cultural constructs. As models, they are reductive, totalitarian, inappropriate to human becoming. As roles, they are static, demeaning to the female, dead-ended for male and female both. Woman-hating 1974.
I love, cherish, and respect women in my mind, in my heart, and in my soul. This love of women is the soil in which my life is rooted. It is the soil of our common life together. My life grows out of this soil. In any other soil, I would die. In whatever ways I am strong because of the power and passion of this nurturant love. Lesbian Pride, 1975.
Men who want to support women in our struggle for freedom and justice should understand that it is not terrifically important to us that they learn to cry. It is important to us that they stop the crimes of violence against us. The Rape Atrocity and the Boy Next Door, 1975.
Being a Jew, one learns to believe in the reality of cruelty, and one learns to recognize indifference to human suffering as a fact. A Feminist Looks at Saudi Arabia, 1978.
Women, for centuries not having access to pornography and now unable to bear looking at the muck on the supermarket shelves, are astonished. Women do not believe that men believe what pornography says about women, but they do. Pornography, Men Possessing Women, 1981.
In using the black woman, pornography depicts the whore by depicting her skin. In using pornography, men spit on her sex and her skin. Here, the relationship of sex and death could not be clearer. The sexual use of the black woman is the death of freedom, the death of justice, the death of equality. Pornography, Men Possessing Women, 1981.
Wild intelligence abhors any narrow world, and the world of women must stay narrow, or the woman is an outlaw. No woman could be Nietzsche or Rimbaud without ending up in a whorehouse or lobotomized. Right-wing Women, 1983.
Frankly, no one knows much what feminist means. The idea of women not defined by sex and reproduction is anathema or baffling. It is the simplest revolutionary idea ever conceived and the most despised. Right-wing Women, 1983.
I am a feminist, not the fun kind. Ice and Fire, 1986.
The political meaning of intercourse for women is the fundamental question of feminism and freedom. Can an occupied people, physically occupied inside, internally, be free? Can those with a metaphysically compromised privacy have self-determination? Can those without a biologically based physical integrity have self-respect? Intercourse, 1987.
There's this Lovelace creature, and she's timid, shy, eager, laughing, grateful. Laughing and grateful, and moaning, you know, the porn moan. Nothing resembling human life. Those stupid fake noises, clown stuff, a sex circus of sex clowns. The smiling ninny down on her knees and after saying, thank you, as girls are born for, so they say. And I think, who is she? Where is she from? Who hurt her? Who hurt her to put her here? Mercy, 1991.
I am asking you to stop passing. Stop having feminism be part of a secret life. I'm asking you not to apologize to anyone for standing up for women. Terror, Torture, and Resistance, 1991.
I truly abhor violence, and I believe that both nationalism and male dominance are systems that promote and produce violence. With extreme difficulty and reluctance, I have come to believe that women have to be literate in both strategic violence and the violence of self-defense. It is one thing to choose not to kill. It is quite another to be defenseless by virtue of ignorance and socialization. Scapegoat the Jews, Israel, and Women's Liberation, 2000.
You can tell the truth, and people can crap all over it, but somehow once it's said, it can't be unsaid. It stays living somewhere in someone's heart.
The worst immorality is to use one's strength to dominate or control. The worst immorality is to surrender the essence of oneself for love or money. The worst immorality is to believe in nothing, do nothing, achieve nothing. Heartbreak, The Political Memoir of a Feminist Militant, 2002.
River Revival, a music and environmental festival. Hope to see you there.
Sky.
This is The Joy of Resistance, and we are Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI. And today we are paying tribute to Andrea Dworkin, who left us on April 9th. We are hearing sounds from her memorial, and we've just read quotes from her voluminous amount of work. And as you can hear, she's really all over the place. She's multifaceted. She's brilliant. She explores lots and lots of territory. And this is not to say there is not room for legitimate disagreement with some of the strategies, such as the anti-pornography ordinances. There are fascinating debates that we hope we'll be able to take up in The Joy of Resistance. But no matter what you think of those issues with which she is identified, I think if anyone who gets into her work will be amazed at the depth of it and the creativity of it. And we're going to go back now to the memorial.
From Kathleen Norris's book, The Virgin of Bennington. In the fall of 1972, my life began to open up. My good friend from college, Andrea Dworkin, returned from Amsterdam, where she had been living, and roomed with me until she found her own apartment in the East Village. For some time, she had been researching and writing her first prose book, Woman Hating. And as always, I was impressed by the way her mind worked over an issue, in this case, the pervasive presence of misogyny in world cultures. Her chapter on Chinese foot binding I found particularly disturbing. In Honolulu, I occasionally had seen elderly Chinese women hobbling along on stunted feet, but I had never comprehended the extreme cruelty of the practice. To create the ideal foot, the toes were sometimes bent under so severely that they withered and fell off. Andrea's keen analysis of this as an erotic practice made me rethink the Charles Jordan shoes I had admired in a store window and saved up to buy, only to find that the fashionably high heels made for difficult walking and painful arches and shins. Andrea and I had met when I was a sophomore at Bennington, and she had returned from a leave she took in 1965 after she had become notorious as the Bennington girl arrested in an anti-Vietnam War demonstration. After being imprisoned in the city's women's house of detention, she had forced a grand jury investigation of the conditions there. In many ways, Andrea's feminism had begun then. It was not lost on her that the prison doctor who performed a gynecological exam on her while smoking a cigarette and without wearing gloves was accustomed to treating prostitutes with such contempt, but that only a middle-class college student would have the wherewithal to make her protest heard. Still, she was not prepared for the first question asked of her at the grand jury hearing. Are you a virgin? Our final tributes will come from Judith Malina and Hanan Reznikoff, followed by Robin Morgan.
I loved Andrea in a very special way, as, of course, all of us who love her do. Even before we met, we wrote each other letters when we were each of us in different years in the women's house of detention for war resisting. Later, she was instrumental in getting that dreadful prison torn down and replaced with a garden. Her words, her books, are like signals from a lighthouse in a stormy sea, cutting through the mists of myth. Those of us who learned her lessons and earned her uncompromising love will never let her brave voice be drowned out by the forces that fear love and love fear. We will stand by Andrea, and now that her rage is calmed, we will keep our pledge to her. Let's renew that pledge now, each of us. We've come together today to do that.
Andrea. Andrea was a tree of life whose thorns had the power to heal those they surprised. She inhabited an Eden from which she would not be expelled, no matter how much it cost to stay. She suffered from what is done to women all over the world all the time. She suffered from the betrayals of her own body. She suffered from the hysterical denunciations that convinced people she advocated things that she never advocated, like censorship. And she suffered from her horror at her own anger. She thought she lived in a violent world, but I think she lived in the garden still. We could be happy here, I seem to have heard her say. We could learn to behave. Her prose is organized like a flower, the petals opening in undreamed-of directions, enlarging our notion of what nature contains and challenging us to decide what it means. She loved literature, and the great writers were celestial lights by which she guided her art. When we first became friends 30-odd years ago, I asked her if she thought there was any significant difference between women and men. She said, "You mean like apples and oranges?"
"No."
For as long as most of us can remember, John was there for Andrea, teaching the lessons of her work and buying the groceries, too. The intimate connection they shared gainsaid the world's timorous notions about what kind of relationships were possible between people who thought such things as they did. She's gone far too soon. Her novel, Ice and Fire, was as agonizingly powerful as Dostoevsky, and it's awful that she didn't get to write more. And it's terribly sad that there will be no more long nights around the table, laughing and gasping at what we have to say to each other and to the world. But what I remember most is her astonishing beauty.
Dearest Andrea, this is a letter because words are what you and I have always been about. Words vibrating between us in conversations and long letters over decades. Of course, today others are eavesdropping, but it's still a letter. I told you, Andrea, that I'd be royally pissed if I ever had to do what I'm doing now. And you promised to stay alive because you said you didn't want to get on my wrong side. But mainly, this is a letter because for me, you simply aren't dead. I'm not in denial. I know you're gone. After years of courageous battle with, as you wryly put it, being medicalized, You are suddenly, unthinkably, at only age 58,
gone.
The sharp intelligence, the fears, the yearnings, the fiery public presence, gone. The sweet-faced young woman I first met about 35 years ago after doing a poetry reading at the Manhattan Theater Club, the young woman just back in the States after almost being killed by a battering husband in Europe, the young woman who followed me into the women's room, slipped a shred of paper with a phone number on it under the cubicle door and asked in what would become a familiar, soft, slightly breathless voice, would I mind please meeting her for coffee to talk to her about this thing called feminism? That young woman is long gone. I got to know you and to love you as we lived, wrote, marched, argued, changed the world, aged. Rarely has any individual so taken her own wounded life, all that fragility, grief, and rage, and alchemized it by will from what it might otherwise have been: despair, madness, silence, death, into something vibrant, something life-givingly useful to others, all through the crucible of intellect and the craft of literature. And others heard. In short, you definitely discovered this thing called feminism. I'd say that I'd miss the conversations we had most, but the truth is they're still going on in my head. Watching press coverage of your death, outpourings of analysis and tribute, reevaluation of your work, I can hear the thrill in that whispery voice of finally feeling that attention is being paid. And then I can hear the dry postscript when the voice deepens. So why in hell couldn't I get some of this when I was still alive? Well, kiddo, you know the answer. The world never honors its prophets, especially writers, and certainly women, until they're safely dead. But see, this is where they get it wrong. You're not safely dead. Because now, you have become language. And in becoming language, oh, my dear, you have only begun to do your work. I love you. We'll talk soon. Robin.
What laws do we need? What would freedom be for us? What principles are necessary for our well-being? Why are women being sold on street corners and tortured in their homes? In societies that claim that they're based on freedom and justice, what actions must be taken? What will it cost us? And why are we too afraid to pay? And are the women who have gotten a little from the women's movement afraid that it will cost them the little that they've gotten? Why are we still making deals with men one by one instead of collectively demanding what we need? I'm going to ask you to remember and that as long as a woman is being bought and sold anywhere in the world, you're not free. You've got a number. Someday your turn's going to come. And I'm going to ask you to remember the prostituted, the homeless, the battered, the raped, the tortured, the murdered, the raped then murdered, the murdered then raped. And I'm going to ask you to remember the photographed. The ones who had all that happen and had it photographed. And now the photographs are for sale in our free countries. I want you to think about those who have been hurt for the fun, the entertainment, the speech of others. Those who have been hurt for profit. I want you to remember the perpetrator. I'm going to ask you to remember the victims and the perpetrators, not just tonight, but tomorrow and the next day, and find a way to include the used in what you do, how you think, how you act, what you care about, what your life means to you. Now, I know, looking in this room, I know that some of you are the women I have been talking about. I know that. The people around you may not. I'm going to ask you to remember, not to forget, to use everything you remember to begin to tear male dominance to pieces, to pull it apart. I have to ask you to resist, not to comply, to destroy the power men have over women, to refuse to accept it, to abhor it, and to do whatever is necessary, despite its cost to you, to change it.
Mm-hmm. And that was the voice of Andrea Dworkin, the great and really brilliant feminist who we are memorializing today by playing sounds from the memorial to her that took place on May 25th. I strongly advise that people read her books and get into her work. I've been doing that, and it's really been enriching. I thought I knew who she was, and I didn't.
It's a constant revelation to read Andrea. She asks the questions that no one else will ask, and when she asks them in print, they resonate and echo in your mind, too. It's impossible to read her and not be challenged and ultimately changed by her work.
And I agree. And as Andrea exhorted us constantly, we not only have to read her work, we have to act, and we have to change the sexism that women are still living under. I want to make some announcements because it's very important to be acting. Tonight, Monday, June 13th, at the office of Rack and Becker at 470 Park Avenue, between 31st and 32nd Street, there's going to be a screening of the film Fundy, The Life of Ella Baker. Following the screening, there's going to be a discussion about the roots of women's liberation movement and the civil rights movement, and the lessons we can take from Ella Baker and the civil rights movement for our women's liberation organizing today. That's sponsored by the monthly meeting of the Women's Liberation Birth Control Project. Again, that's tonight at Raffin Becker, 470 Park Avenue, 3rd floor north. You can call 917-842-5306, 917-842-5306. Or email the Now Task Force at Yahoo.com. That's Now Task Force at Yahoo.com. New York Men Against Sexism is a group that came out of the work of John Stoltenberg. That's Andrea Dworkin's life partner. He wrote Refusing to Be a Man and The End of Manhood, and that is a group of men who fight sexism. Their phone number is 212-316-1654. 212-316-1654, and they meet monthly. If you would like to do direct action against the constant harassment and intimidation that women experience in public spaces, get in touch with the Street Harassment Project. That's at 212-696-8606, 212-696-8606, or go to their website at streetharassmentproject.org. They're an ongoing, very important group. All right, I really, really want to thank a number of people for making this broadcast possible. I want to thank John Stoltenberg. I want to thank Michael David Gordon and John Breitbart of New York Men Against Sexism. I want to thank the Schlesinger Library for sending us the tapes of Andrea speaking. And I want to thank my guest, Reverend Rosemary Bray McNatt. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
And we're going to be doing some more on Andrea Dworkin because her work demands deeper discussion, and it also demands debate. And I'm hoping we can do that debate. But whether you are for or against some of the legislation that Andrea and co-worker Catherine McKinnon sponsored. You've got to read Andrea, because there is no disputing what she is saying about the world in which we live. And The Joy of Resistance can be heard the second Monday of every month at 10 to 11 a.m. You can get in touch with us at 209-2987, 212-209-2987, or email us at joyofresistance@wbai.org, and we'll see you next month.
Avec mes souvenirs, j'ai allumé le feu, mes chagrins, mes plaisirs, je n'ai plus besoin d'eux.